Welcome, everybody. This is the fourth lecture in the Mises Academy online class, The Basics of Economics, the Free Market. And this lecture is titled Income, Saving, and Investment. And it is January 30th, 2014, as we record this. Let me just mention, for those who have it handy, your physical Lessons for the Young Economist. If you have that, you would benefit from having it accessible during this lecture, and we're working through lesson 10 in the book, because in a bit we're going to walk through some of the tables in the book, and I put excerpts from them or screenshots into this PowerPoint, but it's going to be a lot easier for you to see it if you have the physical book in front of you, or failing that, even if you just get the PDF. Which, of course, you know, just Google Robert Murphy Lessons for the Young Economist PDF and you'll get it if you don't have it already. And just open that up and have it in front of you there. So this is one lecture in particular where if you normally listen to these things in your car or at the gym or something, you might want to save this one for when you can be looking at those things. Okay. Oh, one last housekeeping announcement. I have written your quizzes for week 2 and week 3, but I just need to actually upload them. So you'll get that later today, as well as the announcement for what this week's office hours are going to be. So you will get all that stuff and we'll be all caught up for my traveling backlog shortly. Okay, so as I say, tonight we're talking about income, saving, and investment. And as usual in this course, I'm going to be trying to thread the needle. On the one hand, I want to make sure younger people who might be taking this class in the context of being homeschooled and have never been exposed to these concepts, I want to make sure I give you a solid foundation. On the other hand, this area in particular of income, saving, and investment is something where the Austrians really have a distinct history, where they differ from the mainstream, and they're just even almost from step one in their approach to these topics. So much so that, a month or two ago, David Friedman, who is Milton Friedman's son, and I'm sure that annoys him, as that's how people define him, but I just want to make sure you know who the guy is. On his blog, somehow it came up. I don't remember what, like if a reader asked him or something. I think I know what it was. I think he had just come back from a conference and there were some Austrian students there or attendees. And they were peppering him with questions. David Friedman is not an Austrian economist. He's a libertarian and an anarcho-capitalist, but he's not an Austrian economist. And so they were talking about that with him, and he said something like, okay, well, name some standard Austrian concept or finding or belief that, you know, the mainstream does not agree with and that, you know, yields interesting implications or something like that. So he was trying to box them into a corner and get them to either basically admit, okay, yeah, Austrians on the important stuff agree with the mainstream economists, and so we're really not that special and we should stop walking around wagging our finger to everybody. Or he was trying to show them that whatever this novel idea is, you can't get it from praxeology, that, you know, it's an empirical issue. Something like that. But my point is, the reason I'm going into this little anecdote is when I went to answer his challenge on my blog, and I wanted to show him like a standard Austrian concept or principle that definitely makes it distinct. And so something that non-Austrian economists would say, well, that's just wrong. Why would you guys think that? And so, yeah, if that's what you guys think, we're not Austrian, then you should have your own school, because that's not part of our economics. And what I picked was this issue of explaining interest. And then it has to do with capital and saving and investment. So we'll get to that at the end of today's lecture. But I just want to motivate that. So again, what I'm doing in this lecture is, on the one hand, at the beginning is going to be really standard basic stuff, but then at the end I'm going to give you a flavor of how it is that the Austrians, at a theoretical conceptual level, explain these standard concepts or relate them to other things going on in the economy. And I just want to make you aware of how that's different from the way you would learn it in a mainstream class. And also, it's not just in terms of the textbook treatment, but also even high-level economists, just they're baffled by how the Austrians approach this stuff. And naturally, my point in bringing that up is because I think the Austrians are right on this. So it's, you know, it's not like I'm going out of my way to bring up something where most economists think the Austrians are wrong, and I kind of agree that the Austrians are wrong. This is an important conceptual point. So part of what we're doing in this course is I'm trying to get you guys to see why is it that some of us professionally have aligned ourselves with this sort of obscure school and consider ourselves Austrian economists rather than just saying, oh, I'm a free market economist. Why do we focus on the Austrian school? And it's because there are a few key areas where the Austrians really are different. And so if you think those are important differences, well, then that's why you would say, okay, I'm actually an Austrian. Okay, so let's go over some of these basic definitions for the material in this chapter. So first of all, income, and here I'm going to just read the definition that I gave you at the back of lesson 10 because I want to make sure I don't just wing it and then say something that's a little bit different and then you get confused when you go to study. So that's why I'm going to be looking off camera and reading it to make sure I say exactly what this textbook definition is, and then I'll pontificate upon it. So what we put here is income, and I broke it up in the glossary, in these new terms section. So I'm looking at page 145 if you're lost. And I broke it up so that income, I first specified it for individuals and then I specified it for businesses. And it's not actually that the economic concept is different. In an abstract enough level, income is income, whether you're talking about income that an individual earned or that a business, but I'm just trying to here to make it more practical, again, in case you know, you're a newcomer, you're somebody in seventh grade or something, you never heard these terms defined. I want to just keep it real practical, okay? So income at the individual level, for our purposes, we're defining it as the amount of money that can be spent on consumption goods in a certain period from the sale of labor and the earnings of other assets, such as stocks, okay? So loosely speaking, income kind of means how much you can enjoy this period without setting yourself back, okay? And we'll see this more in a few minutes when we work through the numerical example. But what I'm trying to get you to see is that it's the way I covered this possibility with that definition is I didn't want to include from you selling assets off or from you borrowing money from people. Okay, so again, if you have that definition in front of you, just look at it again, and it may have seemed more innocuous than it was. I'm not saying that income is simply the amount of money that can be spent on consumption goods in a certain period. I didn't just end the definition there, and I'm explaining why. Because consumption is different from income, right? Consumption is saying how many enjoyments do you go through in a period? And with all these things, we're measuring it in terms of money because that's the only possible way you could measure it. Or otherwise, it would just be a subjective concept and it wouldn't be capable of any kind of quantification. Okay, but we can, if we want to try to quantify it, we can say, okay, yeah, this person had $50,000 worth of consumption last year. And so I'm saying income is not the same thing as consumption. but income is closely related to consumption, because income is saying, here's how much you could consume without, like I say, in a sense, setting yourself back. Okay, it's if you just wanted to tread water in terms of your wealth, then your income is how much you could consume and sort of stay even. And again, this will make more sense when we get to the numerical example. But given now that you see the issue there, so it's because you could consume more than your income. For example, you might borrow $1,000 from somebody and then go spend it on a trip to Mexico, and you know, you go out to all kinds of restaurants and have a good time, and so now you're out that $1,000. So notice you just dug yourself a hole of $1,000 because you had to borrow the money, and now you got nothing to show for it except the memories. See what I'm saying? So in that context there, you that wasn't income, that was your consumption. All right. So the way I'm trying to just, without making it too technical, because again, this is an introductory textbook, and so that's why I didn't want to make it too complicated, but I tried to show you the types of money flowing in that you're allowed to spend on consumption, that it's not setting you back. And so I said, for example, from the sale of labor services or from the earnings of other assets such as stocks. And so just be careful there. I'm not saying that if you have stock that's worth $1,000 and you sell it, and then you take the $1,000 and go to Mexico on a vacation, that was income that you decided to consume. That's not correct, right? Because now you just dug yourself into a hole. You started out owning all that stock, and now you don't own anything, and all of a sudden, you frittered it away. So you took your wealth and you turned it into enjoyments. You know, there's nothing wrong with that, but that's not income. Okay, that's consuming your capital. That's eating through your wealth. So what I'm saying here in this definition is, if you own stock and then you get dividends out because you're a shareholder, right? So you get a check for $60 or something because you own a certain number of shares. You own 10 shares of stock and each share pays $6 that year. And so you get a check for $60. You can go spend that at the movie theater and take your date and consume $60 worth of stuff, and that's income, right? Because you still own the same shares of stock that you did before. You get what I'm saying? You're not giving away or you're not selling off your wealth. You're just consuming the income that your wealth is generating, in this particular example, in the form of the stock that you own. Okay, so I'm spending a lot of time on this first one because I just want to make sure you don't read more into that definition that's really there. And I actually struggled with this, believe it or not. These definitions right here, I think this was the hardest part for me to do when I wrote this book, is struggling with these definitions, because the definition of income is actually really tricky. I mean, Friedrich Hayek spent several pages in his book, The Pure Theory of Capital, defining what he meant by income, believe it or not. Right? And so you might think, what are you talking about? Everyone knows what income is. No, it gets really tricky when you define that. All right. I might as well go down the rabbit hole on this. If you're a younger person doing a homeschooling, I'm getting really esoteric here. So don't worry, you know, just if you just focus on the textbook and you understand how to answer the textbook questions, you're fine. But I want the more advanced people to understand and to appreciate why it is that me just trying to type up a simple definition for income was so tricky. Even with the example I just gave a couple minutes ago, where I said you own shares of stock and then it pays you a dividend, and so now you can go consume it. A lot of economists would say, well, you know, I'm not sure, Bob. What if the market value of your stock went down? You know, so what if the stock was worth, so what did I say, you had 10 shares? So what if originally the shares were $10 a piece, and so you thought you had $100 worth of stocks, and then the shares dropped, so that now they're only worth, let's say they fell in half. So now they're only $5 a piece, and so now you got $50 worth of stock. And then you get a dividend check from them. Some economists would say, well, no, you can't go spend that dividend because you need to use that to buy more stock and try to get back to your starting point. If you started out and your stock was worth 100, and now because the market price fell, it's only worth 50, that right there was a $50 loss in your wealth. You know, it was a $50, it was like a negative income. It's the opposite of a capital gain. It's a capital loss. And so you need to earn $50 elsewhere just to break even so that your income is zero. Otherwise, your income is negative. So you see what I'm saying? It gets really tricky how you want to quantify this stuff when you start making it more realistic. So it's easy enough when you're thinking of it just in terms of a worker getting a paycheck. Usually we just say, well, that's your income. And even there, though, if you really want to push it, and these are all the things I struggle with when you come up with this definition. I mean, what if you work in a really stressful job and you push yourself and you just keep working overtime, 80-hour weeks, and that physically takes a toll on your body and messes you up so that you're not able to work as well down the road because you pushed yourself so hard in the first few years of this really stressful position and maybe work 80 hours a week, you're shot. You just, oh, man, I can't work anymore. Or you do something physically demanding. You do some job where you're always like on your knees and stocking shelves or something, and then you actually cause physical damage to your knees. I mean, some people would say, well, you got to take that into account when you and get your depreciating your body's capital or something. Okay. So anyway, I'm gonna move on because for those of you who are younger, I'm saying stuff that's way above what you need to know for this course. I'm just trying to get you guys to see that this is actually a lot of times it's harder to explain something in an elementary level than it is to explain it like to a graduate student. If I were teaching a course to people getting a PhD in economics, it would be easier for me to talk about capital income to them than it is to talk to people who might be in junior high. Because again, in trying to boil it down to language that younger people can understand, you end up having to say stuff that's not quite true. Whereas the people getting a PhD, I could use the really precise language and terminology and so forth, so I could say very accurate things. Okay. Why don't I move on? Just one second. Okay, he's not signing. Okay. So if we're talking about incomes in the context of a business, another term you might use is earnings. And there, if we're talking about in terms of money, then it's just revenues minus expenses. Okay, savings, that's the amount by which income is greater than spending on consumption. Okay, so once you have income down, once you nail down what you mean by that term, and you know what consumption is, we've already talked about that, well then, savings is the difference. If your income is higher than consumption, that difference is savings. Or another way of saying it is, if you live below your means, then that's what savings are, okay? And then borrowing or dissaving, of course, is the opposite. If you live above your means, right? If you're consuming more than your income, the way you finance that is through either borrowing or dis-saving. Okay, so again, I'm just trying to emphasize your income is not in any given period how much you consume. It's possible for you to consume more than your income. And if you do that, you either go into debt or your wealth goes down, right? So I think it's easy enough for us to understand if you start at the zero point, you have no assets, no wealth, and then let's just for simplicity. So you don't have any kind of job, you don't have any kind of income, and you want to consume $1,000 of stuff, you need to borrow from somebody. So you do. So now you're in debt $1,000 because you consumed more than your income. But what if you started out and you had $1,000 saved up from before? And so now this period, you want to go spend $1,000 on stuff, on consumption. You can do that. But it wasn't income. If the way you finance it is not because this period, when you're doing the consuming, you worked and you earned a salary. It's not because you owned stock that generated dividend checks. And it's not that you in some other way generated the income, but rather you just took $1,000 that you had previously saved up in prior periods, and you spend down that $1,000. Well, you didn't borrow, but you lived above your means, and so the way you described it is to say it was dis-saving. It's like anti-saving. So again, if saving means you live below your means, you consume less than your income so that you build up your wealth, dis-saving is the opposite. You live above your means. You consume more than your income so that you whittle down your wealth. And you, incidentally, you could do both. You could borrow and dis-save at the same time so that, let's say you had $1,000 in cash, but for some reason you didn't want to use that. You didn't want to touch that. Like maybe it was in a safe deposit box at the bank and you didn't want to go get it. You could just borrow $100 from your buddy and then go buy $100 worth of food at a fancy restaurant. So there, you borrowed $100. You say, oh, I still got $1,000 in my safe deposit box. Yeah, but now you owe this guy $100. So on net now, your net worth is only $900 because you have $1,000 in cash that's still sitting in your safe deposit box, but now you owe this guy $100. Right? So the $1,000 you have minus the $100 you owe him leaves you net $900. So in the beginning, you started out with $1,000 of assets, and now you only have $900. So you still dis-saved by 100, it's just a particular form it took was through borrowing. Whereas if you didn't want to borrow, you could have just gone to the bank, opened up your safe deposit box and taken out $100 and closed it back up and then gone to the restaurant and spent that. So there, you didn't really borrow from anybody explicitly, but you still dis-saved. And obviously, you're not going to keep green pieces of paper in a safe deposit box. In most cases, I'm just using it to keep the example simple. Okay, so then now what is investment? Savings that are spent in the hopes of increasing future income. Okay, so you see how these definitions are building on each other. We couldn't define investment without first knowing what savings are. And what income is, because we're defining investment as what you do with a certain amount of today's savings or this period's savings in reference to future income. So let's make sure you understand both elements of that. Savings is a prerequisite to investment. The only way you can invest is if you have savings. The only way you can invest on net is if you have savings. And what makes something investment as opposed to consumption, it's not whether or not you spend money, right? If you're going to make an investment, you spend money. So try to, if you really want to get crisper with your terminology, you don't want to use the term spending interchangeably with consuming. And some people do that. I mean, I probably even have done it perhaps in this lecture, but you get what I'm saying? So it's not right to say, oh yeah, he just went out and spent a bunch of money, by which you mean he blew it on immediate enjoyments. Because if I'm a business person and I want to get tools and equipment for my factory, it would be a true statement to say, I just went out and spent a bunch of money. If I happen to go to the various suppliers of the ball bearings and gear, treadmill-like devices for my assembly line and so forth. I would go, maybe going around town writing checks to all kinds of different people so they can deliver stuff to my factory the next week so I could start production. So yeah, I spent a bunch of money, but it wasn't on consumption, it was on investment. So what makes a given expenditure investment? It's nothing about the physical thing. It's not about the attributes of the object of the spending. Rather, it refers to the subjective plan that the person spending the money has. And so if your plan is to acquire whatever it is that you're spending the money on because you think that will make your future income higher, then that's an investment. I'm trying to think of a good example. So you could, even buying bologna could be an investment. So how could it be an investment? That's clearly a consumption good. No. What if I'm buying a bunch of bologna because I'm hiring workers and I'm going to feed them? You know, that's part of the compensation package that I tell them. You know, you come to the work site, I'm going to give you $50 in wages, and I'm also going to provide you guys with lunch. And it's going to be bologna sandwiches. So I go to the store, and I'm buying bologna, and I'm buying bread and mustard and blah, 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 and paper plates or whatever. Someone looking at me might say, oh, he's throwing a party. That's consumption expenditure. But they would be wrong. No, when I'm investing in my business just as surely as if I go to the hardware store and I start buying all kinds of hammers and stuff for the workers to use. Okay, so what makes something investment is that you're spending money with the hopes of boosting your future income. And so in that particular example, in case you're not seeing the end point, me buying the bologna is going to boost my future income because that's part of what I said to the workers, right? The whole reason I have workers coming to my work site is to do something that's going to make my income higher. Because it's a business enterprise. If I really were just throwing a party, well, then that would be consumption expenditures. So if I'm having a New Year's Eve party, I go out and buy a bunch of champagne, but that's not an investment. Okay, and then finally, interest. The income earned during a period of time from lending savings to others. Interest is usually quoted as a percentage of the principal, which is the amount of money originally lent, earned per year. For example, if someone lends $1,000 today and is paid back $1,050 12 months later, then the principal is $1,000, the interest earned is $50, and the interest rate is 5%. Okay, so a lot of times we quote interest in terms of percentages, but I just want to make sure you get the idea that conceptually, interest is an amount of money. Just like if you say, what was your salary last year? You might say, oh, $80,000. You wouldn't say 8%. What does that mean? And so if I say, how much interest did you earn last year? Or what was your interest income last year? You should be telling me a dollar figure to say this is how many total dollars I earned, or yen or euros, whatever. This is how much I earned as interest, in the form of interest. It wasn't wages. It wasn't entrepreneurial profit. It was interest. And so it would be quoted in dollar terms or money terms, just like my wages would be quoted in money terms. But a lot of times when we talk about interest, we quote it as a percentage, and that's because, it's a convention, and the reason is that because interest is an earning having to do with your financial capital, it's easy to relate the interest in the form of money to the monetary amount of the original sum. And so they're the same units, and so it's easy to express it as a percentage. Whereas to say, what percentage was your wage? So what are you talking about? I mean, my wages were $80,000 for my salary, but what would I divide that by to come up with a percentage? What's the denominator? I don't know. My body? What's 80,000 divided by my body? What does that even mean? See what I'm saying? Whereas if you say, oh, I lent somebody $1,000 and I earned $50 in interest income, and someone says, well, yeah, but what percentage was that? It's easy to say, oh, 50 divided by 1,000. Okay? So that's why the convention is that we often express interest in terms of percentages, but I just want you to see that interest as a concept is a type of income. And consequently, at a fundamental level, it's money, or it's in the form of money or units of money. But just as a convention, we often express it as a percentage. Okay. Now what we're going to do is I just want to make sure you guys know how to read these diagrams. So this is from lesson 10. We're going to walk through this sort of silly, simplistic example of twins, Prodigal Paul versus his brother Frugal Freddy. And I think you all know what the word frugal means. It means somebody who's saves a lot and is very careful and cheap, perhaps. If you say, oh yeah, that guy's very frugal, what you mean is he's careful with money and he doesn't waste a lot of money on things. Whereas prodigal means somebody who lives it up. So the biblical story of the prodigal son, the kid that gets his inheritance early and then goes and blows it on wild living and it comes back penniless. Okay? So, like I said before, I do have these snapshots here on the PowerPoint, but if you have it in front of you, it'll be probably easier for you to walk through it. So here, let me just first of all explain how these tables work. I'm not going to take too long on this because it should be almost self-explanatory, but I just want to make sure you guys know how to read these because it is important that you work through an example like this numerically to see the power of compound interest. That's one of the main reasons that I went through this example is for younger people. I want you to see why it's so important for you to save. And there's no better way to emphasize that than to show you, look at anybody can become a millionaire. And I just remember I was astounded when I first learned that when I was younger. And so we'll get to that in a few minutes here, but that's one of the reasons I went through that. But that demonstration won't really ring true unless you know how to read these tables. So I just want to make sure I'm not leaving anybody behind. Okay, so obviously the year it goes across, the total market value of the assets in the beginning of the first year, it's going to be zero. Labor income is the paycheck. And it's $50,000, and it's like that for both people as long as they're working. Okay, so we're going to show them working for decades. It's some job where the paycheck they get is $50,000 a year. And it's in real life that would probably go up, and then maybe it would start to go down as the person got older. But just for simplicity, we're going to say, no, year after year, these two twins earn $50,000, and they both start out with zero. In terms of assets, all they have initially in year one is their raw labor power, their skills that they have in terms of their mind and body. They don't have any other assets to their name. And these guys are identical in the beginning. And so what the big picture of what we're doing in this example is to show you, look at what happened based on their behavior. That because Paul is prodigal and is not going to save very much, in the beginning, he's going to consume more. He's going to have a more fun lifestyle. He's going to be living large. His brother, Frugal Freddy, is not going to have as fun of a lifestyle because Freddy's saving more. But we're going to see that this, so you might, just looking at that, looking at the first few years, you might say, why the heck would anybody want to save? clearly Paul has a better lifestyle than Freddie does. But we'll see that eventually Freddie's frugality pays off, literally, and his consumption eventually will be high. But we'll get to that in a minute. But in order for you to see that, you got to know how this table works. So that's what I'm doing right now, is make sure you understand where these numbers are coming from. Okay, so we're just looking at year one here. The earnings from assets, and I'm assuming 5% interest. So each year, you go and you look up and say, what were the total market value of the assets? And you multiply it by 5%, and then that's where this number would come from. In this year number one, obviously that number is zero. That's that little line you mean nothing, because he didn't have any assets this year. So he earned zero in interest income in year one. Okay, so what's his total income? That's going to be the labor income plus the earnings from his assets. So in this case, it's 50,000 plus zero, which is just 50,000. Now, what's his consumption? Okay, so now here's where we're going to make some assumptions. We're assuming that Prodigal Paul consumed 95% of his income. So that means he just saves 5% of his income each period. Now, in the grand scheme of things, compared to reality, actually, that's not terrible, because a lot of Americans, I don't know exactly what the trends are like in other countries, a lot of Americans don't even save 5% of their income, if you're talking about after-tax income. If you're talking about pre-tax income. But nonetheless, I wanted to keep the math simple, and so it was easier to do 95% consumption and 5% rather than, you know, making them only save 1% or something. Then the math would just get trickier. Okay? And so what we're going to see is that Freddie saves more than Paul does. Okay, so to figure out the consumption in a given period for Paul, what you do is you multiply 95% times the total income. So this period, the total income was 50,000. So 95% of that is 47,500. So what that means, what's left, saving of 5% in this period is 2,500. Okay, so to recap, in period one, Paul starts out with nothing, no assets. All he's got is his mind and body. He goes, gets a job, and gets a $50,000 salary. That's what his paycheck is from his employer. Out of that, he saves 2,500, which is 5%. And he consumes 47,500. Okay, so last thing, he invests in assets this period of 2,500. So he takes his savings and then he does something with it. Specifically, we're assuming he buys assets that will yield a rate of return of 5%. So maybe he goes and banks had these, what are called certificates of deposit, or CDs. So maybe he buys a bunch of those that will yield 5% per year. Okay. Now we'll just walk through. It'll be quicker to go through these other years. I just want to make sure you get the pattern. So the way you read this table is you start in a given column, you work your way down, and then you go back to the top of the next column. So now we're in year two. The total market value of assets here is 2,500, and that number we are pulling up from the bottom, right? Well, strictly speaking, what it is, it's the last period's starting value plus last period's investment then gives you the new starting value. So before, in period one, they started out with $0 in assets and then invested 2,500. So that's why in period two, you start out with 2,500 in assets. Okay, so notice Paul is in a better position at the start of year two than he was at the start of year one. Because at the start of year two, now, in addition to his body and mind, you know, that give rise to his labor service power or ability to earn labor income, he also has $2,500 worth of assets. Perhaps they're CDs that he bought from the commercial bank. Okay. Again, CD, I don't mean like a musical CD. CD stands for certificate of deposit. Okay. I just want to make sure I wasn't losing anybody in the comments. Okay, so I'll work, like I say, I'll speed up now. I just don't want to lose anybody on these initial computations. Okay, labor income, year two, again, is 50,000. Earnings from assets, so now this is a positive number. So remember, it's 5% interest. So what's 5% of the 2,500? That's $125. Right? Because 10% would be 250. So half of that is 125. This half of 10% is 5%. Right? So 5% of 2,500 is $125. So his total income is $50,125. Notice that that's bigger than 50,000. Because this period in year two, he gets $50,000 from his job, from his employer. That's what his salary is, like it always is going to be while he's working. But now, in addition, that $2,500 that he invested last year has yielded or thrown off $125 of interest income. And it really is income. This is now an extra $125 that he can spend free and clear without reducing the value of his assets. Okay, so consumption, now the math gets a little bit messier. 95% of 50,125, rounded to the nearest dollar, is 47,619. And so then the balance, 2,506, is what he saves, because that's 5% of his income. So notice he saves a little bit more. He saves $6 more this year than he did last year. Why? Because his income was $125 more. And since he always saves 5% of his income, if his income goes up $125, that means the absolute dollar amount of his savings goes up about $6, rounding off. Okay? And so the investment this period in assets is $2,506. So that means now at the start of year three, the total market value of his assets is $5,006. Let me just explain where that number came from. That's what you guys need to know for how these tables work. Okay, because at the end of period, sorry, at the beginning of period two, his assets were $2,500. During the course of the year, he went out and bought $2,506 more of assets. So now at the beginning of year three, you say, well, how much, what's the market value of his assets now? It's the original $2,500 from the start of period two plus the new $2,506 that he accumulated during period two. So $2,500 plus $2,506 is $5,006, and that's where this number at the top of year three comes from. All right. You might, let me just say one last clarifying point here. You might be getting a little bit worried and saying, wait a minute, though. Not only did he start year two with $2,500 in assets and then invested $2,506, but those assets also generated $125. In other words, those assets, if he just didn't touch them, would be growing exponentially. They'd be growing at 5%. So shouldn't we add that 5% in somewhere? Well, we've already done that. We've already accounted for that, right? That 125 we showed here, and then that formed part of this income of the 50,125. And so then this 2506 already got the contribution from the 125. Another way of putting it is Paul is not taking that $2,500 in assets and putting it in the corner and just letting it sit there. Because he's actually, yes, it's growing at 5%, but Paul each year actually consumes 95% of that growth. Okay? I mean, that's kind of a subtle point. Make sure you get that. Paul has this pile of assets. So at the beginning of year two, he's got this $2,500 that he purchased the prior period. And in period two, that $2,500 in assets yields 5% growth. But Paul does not, the income from that the 125 that it grows, Paul actually consumes 95% of it and only leaves 5% remaining in the pile. But out of his paycheck, which is $50,000, he also takes 5% of that and uses it to buy assets. So on net, he still is investing a lot, you know, compared to the, you know, so he's still kicking in and he's accumulating assets. His assets are growing. But I'm just explaining to you, in case you're getting mixed up about, well, how come this isn't growing exponentially? Part of it is because he's consuming the income. So it is growing. It's growing more than exponentially. He's kicking in more than 5%. This is growing way more than 5%. Going from 2,500 to 5,006 is a huge increase. It more than doubled. But I'm just explaining to you the sources of that growth. It's not that Paul's letting it just sit in the corner. He's not touching it. Rather, he's taking his income from all sources, putting them in a common bucket, and then saying, okay, what's my total income this period? I'm going to save 5% of it. Okay. Now I just want to make this point about the consumption break-even year. So the top person is Prodigal Paul, and the bottom person is Frugal Freddy. Notice Frugal Freddy, I really exaggerated this just to show you, just to make the numbers diverge quickly. He only consumes 70% of his income, which means every period he saves 30%. I was just double checking to make sure I wasn't misreading the tiny print on the PowerPoint. Okay? So the logic of the accounting is the same. The principles are the same. The rules for moving through the tables, the cells in the table, are the same for Frugal Freddy as Prodigal Paul. Also, the labor income is always the same for the two brothers. So I'm just trying to show you the only difference between these two guys is that every period, Prodigal Paul saves 5% of his income, whereas Frugal Freddy saves 30%. That's the whole point of this exercise, just to show you how that one difference over time leads to humongous outcomes or differences in the outcome. Okay, so like I said, up front, let's just look at year four, for example. I'm going to be switching to my textbook because it's easier for me to read the numbers. Okay, so if you look at year four, Prodigal Paul has 75,19 in assets. In contrast, Frugal Freddy has 45,600 and change in assets. Okay, so you can see because of the difference in their saving, Frugal Freddy is investing a lot more each period. So his assets are growing much more quickly. So at any given period, as you move forward, Frugal Freddy's assets are going to have a much higher market value than Paul's. But the downside of that is, look at their consumption in these early years. Frugal Freddy's not having a fun time at all. So again, in year four, just for example, Frugal Freddy's consumption is $36,599. Whereas Prodigal Paul, his consumption in year four is $47,857. Right? So Paul consumes what? $11,000 in change more. Okay, so that I'm saying Paul in year four gets to consume $11,000 plus of extra enjoyments compared to what Freddie does. So I mean that's, you know, you could take a trip to Vegas and do a lot of gambling and go see a lot of shows there with $11,000. You could probably take two vacations, pretty nice ones, spending just $11,000. Okay, so while Paul's going to Miami Beach in Vegas and just having a great time in year four, Frugal Freddy says, no, I can't afford to do that. I can't go on any vacations because I really want to save $15,600 this year, specifically $15,685, not the exact number. In contrast, Prodigal Paul only saves $2,519. Okay, so that's one, that's the primary explanation for what they do with their money in year four. Actually, that doesn't quite account for the difference, because Frugal Freddy's income is a little bit higher in year four than Prodigal Paul's income, because Freddy, even by year four, has already built up a lot more in assets, and so his interest income is higher than Freddy's. Higher than Paul's. Okay, but a huge component of how can it be that Prodigal Paul is spending $11,000 more in consumption compared to Frugal Freddy. The main explanation as of year four is that because Freddy is saving that and Paul is not. That's the main way to account for the difference in consumption. Okay, so again, just to repeat, let me just see how much the income is. So their income, just make sure you're with me. Frugal Freddy's income in year four is $52,284, whereas Paul's is $50,376. Okay, so Frugal Freddy makes almost $2,000 more in income. And of that, Freddy goes and invests a lot, whereas Paul enjoys it, consumes it. Maybe he goes on vacation. Okay, so if that were the end of the story, you'd say, why the heck does anybody ever save? That's stupid. But if you look ahead to year, where is this? Is it year 26? Yeah. So in year 26, well, let me stop there. One reason is, even that you see already, is just building up the wealth. So if for some reason either of these guys needed to pay for some big ticket expense, like their spouse got into a serious car accident and they didn't have health insurance and they had huge medical bills, or you know, whatever, or their brother lost his job and asked, geez, can you lend me some money to feed my family till I get back on my feet? Even by year four, you know, Prodigal Paul's only got $7,500 to his name. So that's the most he has to draw on in case there's some kind of situation like that. Whereas Frugal Freddy's got $45,678. So I don't mean to say that you can't already immediately see the advantage of saving. But what I'm trying to show you is, even this difference in lifestyle, eventually Frugal Freddy's strategy or approach will allow him to have the best of both worlds. That not only is he going to have way more saved up, and not only is he going to have a much higher income each year, but actually his consumption will eventually outstrip Prodigal Paul's. And specifically with these numbers, that happens in year 26. And that's why I put those little gray boxes. So here, this is year 26. You can see it. There's that gray box and this gray box. So why did I single these cells out among many of the others? It's because this is the year where finally Frugal Freddy's consumption is even higher than Prodigal Paul. Okay, so thus far, the first 25 years, Freddy is saving more, and so that means from year two onward, his income is higher, and that his assets are always higher. But from year one through 25, Prodigal Paul at least could say, well, I'm having a better lifestyle than you are. I'm having more fun. I'm consuming more. I'm enjoying life more. But even that falls away by year six, because there, this number is $50,560, whereas this number is 50,783. Okay, so by year 26, let me just make sure you get it, even though Frugal Freddy is still only consuming 70% of his income, his income has now grown so much more than Prodigal Paul's that 70% of Freddy's income yields a bigger number, absolute number in dollar terms, than the 95% of Prodigal Paul's income. Okay, so it's not that either of them have changed their Satan's behavior. It's just that Freddy's base, if you will, is growing so much more rapidly that eventually 70% of his income is a bigger number than 95% of Paul's income. Okay, so that's what happens in that year of 26. Also, just so you guys know, obviously in this stuff, we're not worrying about price inflation. We're not worrying about taxes, stuff like that. So this is, it's just to make the, to isolate one issue of saving an investment. And so we're not worrying about those other factors. That would just complicate the analysis. We're just trying to home in on what would happen if you had a constant labor income and one guy saved a lot of it and the other person only saved a little bit. Okay, that Freddy is a millionaire. Look at this. By year 48, why did I highlight this? Because this is the year when Freddie's market, the total market value of his assets has broken the 1 million mark. So if he started working when he was 20, he would only be 68 years old at this time. And remember, we didn't have to assume that he was some Silicon Valley entrepreneur. He didn't found some company. He just worked at a normal job where he earned year after year a $50,000 paycheck. But the way he became a millionaire, if by millionaire we mean someone who has $1 million or more in assets, is he just was very disciplined with his savings. Year after year, he would plunk away 30% of his income. And that's how he managed to accumulate $1 million. And we made very conservative assumptions here that each year he only earned 5% interest. Okay, so on the other hand, there's no tax man, there's no IRS robbing him every year. And so that's partly why he's able to get up to $1 million, whereas in today's world, in the United States, if you just earn $50,000 a year, you probably wouldn't be able to build up $1 million, even in nominal terms, let alone adjusting for the price level, because it would be hard for you to save that much. And depending on what you put your money in, you know, if you put it in the stock market, given what the Fed's doing, it might have really high growth and then it might collapse. So these assumptions, do with them what you will. In one sense, they're very optimistic. In the other sense, they're very conservative. But the point is, you might not have realized someone who just has access to a 5% rate of return investment and who only earns $50,000 a year, nonetheless, if he's disciplined and saves 30% a year, will accumulate $1 million. By the 48th year of doing that. And so, again, that's the point of me stressing this is to say, don't think of it as, oh, to be a millionaire, to have $1 million, you gotta do something special and get some high income somehow. No, you don't have to. I mean, don't give up on that. Still brainstorm and try to figure out ways to become an entrepreneur and earn $600,000 in a year. By all means, I'm not telling you to not do that. But what I am saying is, even on some modest paycheck, if you're disciplined over time, when you go to retire, you will have more than $1 million. Okay. So speaking of retirement, the golden years here. Incidentally, let me just say, I know this guy, Nelson Nash, who's a a lecturer and a fan of Austrian economics that I know from my consulting business. And when he gives talks, he tells people there's no such thing as retirement. And so he tries to knock that out of them. He calls it passive income years. Because what he's saying is don't ever stop working. Don't just say, okay, now I'm just going to have fun for the rest of my life. He thinks that's a ridiculous mentality that was inculcated in the Prussian model of, you know, managing the economy from the state. And okay, you've got people are born, they go to state schools, they get educated to become good workers, they work for a few decades, pay their money into the public coffers for Social Security and all that, and then we need to get rid of them to make room for the new generation of workers to come through. So you guys got to retire. You see how it's all managed and everything. And so Nelson Nash thinks that's just a crazy paradigm, and that don't ever plan on not being productive and earning income. Especially don't think that, oh, when I turn 65, then I'm just going to play golf. That, you know, he's saying, no, you still have a lot of wisdom, and especially with advances in medicine. When you're 65, you're still in very good health, and you can be doing all kinds of stuff besides just consuming. But anyway, I digress. Back to the point, I'm trying to show here that if you have been disciplined and saved during your prime working years so that you build up a huge stockpile of assets, that's what allows you to live comfortably once you no longer work and get a late, you know, get a paycheck. And so I just showed that between the two brothers there, they start drawing down their savings. So let's see. What happens in year 52, I don't think I have it here. I don't have it on the PowerPoint. But in year 52, you can see that $50,000 disappears. And so the idea there is they're no longer, they have retired from their former, their job. You know, wherever they went to work for all these years, getting that $50,000 paycheck. They said, okay, I put in lots of years here, but I'm done. I worked here 52 years or 51 years. I'm done, guys. Thanks for the memories. And now they're on their own and they just have their assets to live off of. And so just to keep it straightforward, just to give it a chance, I said, okay, Prodigal Paul from year 52 onward, he just consumes $15,000 a year. Whereas Frugal Freddy, I just had him in his retirement phase consuming $70,000 a year. So you can see the huge difference in lifestyle they can both afford. I mean, Frugal Freddy's probably living in a really nice place in Florida, golfing all the time, taking trips to see his grandkids and giving them big presents for their birthdays and stuff like that. Whereas Prodigal Paul, he's on a much more modest budget. You know, he probably lives in a rundown area, or, you know, in a dinky little apartment perhaps somewhere, not in a really nice location where the real estate's expensive. And he certainly is not traveling around the country, and he's not sending big checks to all his grandkids on their birthdays, because he just couldn't afford to do that. Okay, and then the crunch time for Paul comes in year 64. And that's what this box is saying. That's showing you that is here. He's completely exhausted his wealth at this point. So that 5384, where that came from, is it's his starting the market value of his assets, which is 5128. The $256 that the assets yielded in interest income, and then his consumption that year, those two numbers put together, 5384. And so then you say, you know, what's the starting value of his wealth next year? It's zero, because this number, his disk saving, was 5128, and that's exactly what he started out with. So he whittled away his assets to zero And so now he starts out year 65 with no assets, so he has no interest income. And he hasn't held a job in years. He's an old guy. So, you know, it's not like he can just go and earn $50,000 again, because he's been retired for years and he's old at this point. So he's in a very precarious position. At this point, he either has to die, you know, starve to death, or go to his relatives and say, hey, can I live? You can take care of me, or get some kind of philanthropic assistance, you know, go to the church or something, or a secular food kitchen, or go to the government. This is a free market, so there's no government giving handouts here, but in the real world, you know, he would be dependent on the state. Okay, so, and then in contrast, you can see Frugal Freddy is fine. In his year 64, he still got $927,000 in assets. His income alone this year was $46,000. All right. Even though he's not working, he's out playing golf, his income in year 64 is $46,000, almost as much as when he was working, how much he was getting from his employer in terms of a salary. And where that's coming from is he's got $927,000 out there at work earning interest. Okay, so there's different ways you can earn income in the market economy. One way is to sell your labor services, but another way is to accumulate capital and then to invest it wisely and earning interest off of it. Okay, so he's, again, just to repeat, his income is $46,368. Make sure you understand what number I'm looking at. And he's not lifting a finger. Well, he's lifting his finger to pull his nine iron out of his golf bag. Okay, so you get how this works. And then also, I just rounded it out. It's not here on the PowerPoint, but just where I rounded it out. In year 75, I assume that Freddie dies. And at this point, he still has $591,640 in assets. And so in his will, he would just give that to various beneficiaries. You know, maybe he's got a charity he likes, or he gives it to some grandkids or his children if they're still alive, what have you. All right, so one last little point on that is, notice Freddie, he was consuming more than his income in his retirement years. He was consuming $70,000 a year, even though his income, depending on which year you looked at it, was like in the 40s. So each year he was dis-saving by 20-some thousand dollars, or even 30. And so that's what was pushing down the value of his assets. But that's fine. I mean, there's nothing. So in the grand scheme of things, what happens with Freddie? Early on, he was living well below his means. He was consuming a lot less than his income, and that was building up his assets. Then when he retired from his official job, he was consuming above his income. He was living above his means. He was engaging in dis-saving, and so that was pushing down the value of his assets. So there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, that's kind of the point. That's partly why he saved so much early on, was because he wanted to have a comfortable retirement period, and he wanted to have a bunch left over to give to his heirs when he died. Okay. So you guys see that? That's my good old Protestant work ethic, the virtue of saving spiel. And, you know, partly why I'm emphasizing that, even though besides just being homey, old style wisdom that would make Ben Franklin have a twinkle in his eye, is the Keynesian worldview is very anti-saving. And if a Keynesian economist heard me say that, he'd probably get all huffy and say, oh, no, you're caricaturing us. But give me a break. I mean, just today on my blog, and by the way, my blog is free advice, or the URL is consultingbyrpm.com. For those of you who somehow got this far in life without knowing about my blog. And I went through, because recently Turkey raised its interest rates pretty drastically because they were getting attacked by currency speculators, and they wanted to defend their currency. They raised interest rates. And Krugman didn't really have any inside information, or he didn't say anything very specific about Turkey. He sort of gave a general explanation about, well, yeah, we're in this period of a stagnation economy, and there's just too much global savings without enough investment opportunity. All right, so I mean, it's just the throwaway line of, well, yeah, there's too much saving right now. People aren't spending enough, either in terms of investment or consumption. And the Keynesian mentality is that, oh, shoot, sometimes people panic and they try to save too much. And so in the aggregate, if everyone's trying to save, then it's self-defeating, and that's what gives us depression. Okay, so that's partly why I'm emphasizing so much from an Austrian perspective, the virtues of saving. Because the Keynesians, and that's what's called the paradox of thrift, in case you've ever heard that term. Let me just type that out. Keynesians cite the paradox of thrift. All right, that's a staple in Keynesian economics to explain depressions, where they claim, oh yeah, from an individual household point of view, saving is good, just like the kind of example I just gave you. But they're going to say, you can imagine situations where if everyone in the economy tries to save, it ruins, it messes everything up, and it's self-defeating. We all end up poorer because we all tried to save and become richer. Okay, so generally speaking, Austrians recoil in horror from that kind of analysis. Okay, so back to just the standard Austrian stuff. The point I want to make now is I want to relate this to the broader economy. And so I'm just kind of calling this micro versus macro. And what I mean by this is, in these demonstrations with Prodigal Paul and Frugal Freddy, it's easy enough to see how having a higher savings rate lets your income grow over time so that eventually you can enjoy more consumption. So you're consuming less in the early years so that your wealth grows, so that your income grows, so that in the future you can enjoy permanently more consumption, a higher level of consumption than otherwise would have been possible. So there's this trade-off over time, or what's called an intertemporal trade-off, or that word intertemporal is just a fancy word meaning across time periods. Okay, so that's obvious when it comes to a couple working on the family budget, saying, oh, geez, you know, I wanted to go to the Super Bowl this year, but, you know, we said, honey, that we were going to save $3,000 for our retirement fund, and so we just, you know, we just don't have the money. We can't go to the Super Bowl this year. The guy's all mad. Okay, but that's because they know if they're frugal now, down the road, they will be glad that they saved more. Okay? And where does that come from? Well, it comes from the fact that if you save, then you can invest and you earn interest, and that makes your income higher. So it's clear in terms of the accounting what's going on. But now what I want to do is relate that to the physical economy. What's going on in the economy? Is it the case that if, in general, everybody in the economy saved a higher fraction of their, if everyone turned into Frugal Freddy, would that work? Or would it blow up in our faces? For Frugal Freddy to exist, does there need to be a Prodigal Paul out there to match up with him so that Freddy saves and like lends the money to Paul, who goes and blows it at the bar? And then down the road, the way Freddy gets paid off is that Prodigal Paul has to take some of his labor paycheck and give it to Freddy. I think that's what a lot of people believe. They think, because it's correct to say for everybody who lends money, there must be someone borrowing money, right? So that's a true statement. But that from that, it does not mean, therefore, in the aggregate, it's always a wash. And that if one person's saving, that means somebody else must be this saving by the same dollar figure, and therefore, on net, the society always breaks even. But that is not true. You can have everybody saving and accumulating. And for our purposes, especially since I'm running low on time here, let me just say the physical analog, the way it is possible that everybody in the community, every household can be Frugal Freddies and can save a big fraction of their income and so that they can have a better lifestyle decade in the future. What's happening physically with the economy is in the early years when everyone becomes a Frugal Freddy, what does that mean? It means they're not going to the Super Bowl. They're not going on vacation. They're not going out to restaurants. They're saving more. And maybe they're giving the money to a commercial banker. Maybe they're investing in a mutual fund. Or maybe they're buying bonds from certain corporations. Or maybe they're taking out really big life insurance policies. Or maybe they're buying gold and silver. Okay, so there's various ways you can invest that money. And so what I'm saying is if everybody is doing that, in the aggregate, what happens? The economy adjusts. Entrepreneurs see the different price signals, and they adjust to the new reality, the new spending patterns. And so instead of the economy producing labor and raw materials to crank out sushi restaurants and pizza parlor joints and new flashy sneakers and Ferraris, instead those resources, the labor power and iron and copper and crude oil and the other raw materials that the economy has to work with, are channeled more into making investment goods. They make hammers and ball bearings and drill presses and 18-wheelers. And they build more factories. Okay, so that's what this picture is trying to show you, that the type of thing that the economy produces, the composition of output, when the community as a whole decides to start saving a much larger fraction of its income, the physical corresponding change is that the economy retools itself. Instead of cranking out pizzas and Big Macs and flashy sneakers, instead now the economy year over year is cranking out books and microscopes and supercomputers and things like that that make us more productive. And so that's how our standard of living can be higher in 30 years because of saving, is because we've physically accumulated a bunch of capital. So even without scientists discovering new technological discoveries, just saving more would make us more productive. One way to illustrate that last point is to say, suppose you had the world's leading engineers and physicists and medical doctors on a cruise ship, you know, the state-of-the-art thing, the guys and women who are the leaders in their respective field, and the ship crashes on a deserted island somewhere, their standard of living is going to plummet. The best engineer, the guy who consults for the leading companies around the world, he's not going to have any tools to work with. He's going to have coconuts and whatever, fish. Right? So the fact that he knows all kinds of, you know, that if you gave him blueprints and or computers with computer-aided design and all that kind of stuff, and he would just be a wizard on that, he can't do anything. He doesn't even have a hammer to work with. Okay, so all of their technical knowledge and know-how is going to be pretty useless because they're not going to have any capital goods to work with on that island initially. It would take them decades to even just get going. So there you could see the constraint would not be their knowledge. It wouldn't be, oh, geez, we need to discover new technological recipes. The constraint would be that they don't have the right capital equipment. Okay, so if you get it there, what I'm saying, that's true for Earth as a whole right now. The one of the constraints on us is not, oh, geez, our scientists need to go discover new stuff. The constraint is we don't have enough capital to work with. We have plenty of technological know-how. If everybody in Africa had the same tools and equipment that workers in the United States had, the productivity of labor in Africa would be a lot higher. Okay, so it's not that, oh, gee, Africa doesn't have any engineers that have been trained at Western universities. No, the problem with Africa is look at what they have to work with, literally. Okay, so, I mean, there's other problems too, but I'm saying in terms of understanding what makes, how much physical stuff can the economy crank out, that's a constraint. So if people save more, that allows businesses to redirect what they're doing, and instead of just cranking out consumer goods, it cranks out more capital goods. And so that eases that constraint, and it makes us, that's what allows our standard of living to be higher. So one last way of putting it, we all have a much higher standard of living now in 2014 than people did 100 years ago in 1914. And yeah, one of the reasons for that is that scientists have made discoveries since then. But another reason is that people, humans in general, have been saving and investing since then. And so we have inherited a larger stockpile of capital equipment to work with. So yeah, we know more about science and engineering and computers and stuff like that now than people 100 years ago did. We have more mental stuff to work with. But we also have more physical things to work with, too. Okay, let me see if you guys have asked any questions. Okay, I don't see any pending questions, so let me go ahead and take the last 8 minutes for this last section. Excuse me. Okay, so that ends the standard basic framework of what I want you guys to know in terms of income, saving, and investment. And now in the last few minutes here in these last three slides, let me just briefly introduce you to what it is that the Austrian economists specifically have to say on this topic that makes them fairly unique among other schools of thought. Okay, so I'm just calling this the Austrians on interest. So the two main players here are Eugen von Bombawerk, and I didn't have time to do it, but this O should have the two little, I can't even draw it well, but it should have those two little dots above, you know how the O's look like this? That's what it should look like. Okay, and so who is this guy? He was the successor of Karl Menger. Okay, so in terms of the hierarchy in the Austrian tradition, the founder is Karl Menger, and then the next generation is Bombawerk and some other guys, and then after Bombawerk comes Mises and some other people, right? I'm not giving you the whole family tree because I don't want to confuse you. I'm just trying to relate in your mind the succession here. Okay, so for our purposes here, I'm not going to get into who did exactly what. So let me just end with two thoughts to help you understand the Austrian approach and why it's distinct. So the first, what do the Austrians do? It can be summed up in the phrase time preference. So specifically, in the Austrian tradition, as pioneered by Bombawerk and then as refined by Mises, and you know, the standard Austrian approach to these topics of capital and saving and interest, when they explain where does interest income come from, what causes interest, they say fundamentally, essentially, it is due to what's called time preference, and that refers to the higher subjective value of present versus future goods. Okay, so other things equal, you would rather have a good today than a good a year from now or 10 years from now. So present goods are more valuable than future goods, both in market value but also in subjective value. And this is where Bombawerk really walks through the details of this, the mechanics of it, when subjective value theory was in its infancy. Okay, so Karl Menger created subjective value theory, and then von Bavert, who was in the next generation of Austrian, took subjective value theory and applied it in an intertemporal context, right? So he took subjective value theory. Well, let me put it to you like this. When Menger wanted to explain, hey, why is it that a steak, why is it that a pound of steak has a higher market value than a pound of hamburgers? Well, the starting point of that explanation is to say, because consumers value, they get more utility, subjective utility on the margin from one more pound of steak than they do from one more pound of hamburger. So the steak has higher marginal utility than the hamburger, and that's the starting point to explain why its market prices are higher. Okay? But von Bavert took that same framework, that same subjective value theory, and he applied it to goods over time. So he didn't look at just steak right now compared to hamburger right now. He said, what about a pound of steak right now compared to a pound of steak that won't be delivered until 12 months from now? And the market price of the steak right now is higher than the market price of a pound of steak that won't be delivered until a year from now. How do I explain that? He said, well, duh, because consumers must value the first thing more than the second thing. That's what Menger taught us. That's how you explain market prices, is through ultimately subjective value. But the trick is, what von Bavert saw that was just brilliant is that interest can be thought of as a higher market value on present goods compared to future goods. That was really the crucial brilliant insight that other people had been missing. And then once you frame it like that, then it's obvious, well, duh, we already know how to explain why one thing has a higher market value than another. It's because it's more subjectively valuable. Duh, that's the standard Mengerian price theory. Okay? So that's how the Austrians approach it. And like I say, that is a very Austrian thing, because mainstream economists, you just grab some random mainstream economist and say, hey, where does interest come from? What explains the equilibrium rate of interest in the market economy? He's going to say, oh, it's because of the marginal product of capital. Okay, so let me just explain to you where they're coming from when they say that. If you grab a mainstream economist and you say, hey, in a market economy, what explains the equilibrium wage rate? You know, so when everything's settled down and everybody has all the information and some worker's getting paid a certain amount in wages, what principles or what forces determine how much that worker's getting paid? The standard mainstream economist response would say, oh, it's the productivity of labor. And that's what the Austrian would say too, right? So that's nothing weird. Okay, so we all get it. And they say, well, why? And they say, oh, because during that period, you know, if the worker generates $100,000 worth of output for the firm, as long as there's competitive labor market, then the worker needs to get paid $100,000 in terms of his salary, his wage. Because if he didn't, then some other firm would offer him more, and, you know, so the competition would cause his wage, cause the worker to be paid the marginal product of his labor. And that's how we explain it. Okay, great, fine. Then you say, okay, the capitalist has $100,000 in capital, and he invests it, and he earns, let's say he earns 5%. So he earns $5,000 in interest income. Why? And the mainstream economists say, oh, because his capital was productive. It generated $5,000 of income for the person who borrowed it, and so that's why, from competition, blah, 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 that's why the capitalist has to earn that. Okay, and I'm saying that, so superficially you can see why, oh yeah, that makes sense. But what von Bavert showed is that in practice, the way economists work with those examples, or with that kind of approach, you tie yourself up in knots, and you end up committing all sorts of fallacies. For this kind of introductory course, I mean, this is what my PhD dissertation was, right? So this is serious stuff. But for our purposes, just to give you a hint or a flavor, a taste of the kind of thing Bombarich said was, wait a minute, that's actually not very good of an explanation. Because he said, wait a minute, the productivity of capital goods explains the rental rate. Right? So if you want to say a tractor is productive, that explains why somebody renting a tractor would pay more for a tractor than he would pay to rent a shovel, because the tractor is more productive than the shovel. But that doesn't explain why, if I had $100,000 and bought a tractor for a price of $100,000, that I would be able to earn 5% interest on that investment in the tractor. All right? If you're saying the reason I earned, if you're telling me the capital that I'm buying is very productive, well, then that should make its price go up. But what we're trying to understand, if I earn 5% of my investment, it means I have to pay $100,000 for the capital goods, do something with them, and then earn $105,000 when all is said and done. That's the way I earn 5% of my investment. That's the 5% interest income. So just telling me capital is productive, the heck are you talking about? How does that explain why I'm able to earn, you know, sell the product for $105,000 when I only had to pay $100,000 up front for all the inputs? To say capital, that doesn't really answer the question. Okay, so like I said, I'll stop right there. In the office hours, if some of you are intrepid and want to delve into that more, you can, or if you're really insane, you can try to read my dissertation. But that's the, or not just my stuff, if you go and read the great Austrian works of Mises and Human Action, or Rothbard and Man, Economy, and State, talking about interests and so on, that you're gonna see the kind of thing I just talked about. Okay, last thing, Steven's asking me about the quiz or quizzes. For those of you who missed in the beginning, I'm going to be posting, we're going to be all caught up with that by tomorrow. Okay, so I have written the quizzes, but I just haven't uploaded them yet. So you're going to get an email blast from me by tomorrow, which is Friday, telling you when the office hours are going to be, and I'm saying the quizzes are all posted. Okay, and I, sorry for the delay, just I was traveling like crazy and fell behind. Okay, so while we're out of time, I will stop there. Kay, I see your question there, and I'll fold that in, and I'll grab it later. Okay, but we're out of time here. I want to let everybody go. Okay, thanks, everybody.